nos pudesse saber que eu sempre fui só de você, você sempre foi só de mim.
WMFO Medford. Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls and library books, there's no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. Good morning, it's the 8th of November, 2023. Thanks to Rick for filling in last weekend when I decided to take it off. It was a late night, Halloween night. So we're going to be sifting through the old card catalog this morning. The dust is making me sneeze.
Mars Incorporated, makers of Milky Way candy bars, invite you to step right up to the fountain of fun. This is John Cornell welcoming you to the fountain of fun, the Crossroads Soda Parlor, where we hear from Phil Brito, the Thrasher Sisters, and Phil Davis and his orchestra. And here's the drip of the fountain, the jerk of the joint, Bob Jellison.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be with you just as soon as I wait on this customer. Now, you say you'd like to have this photograph retouched. Well, we can do a nice job for you. Any suggestions?
Well, it's my uncle, see? He's got his hat on, see? And we'd like to have it show him without his hat on, see?
Uh-huh. Well, we can remove the hat, all right. Now, which side did he part his hair on so we can retouch it properly?
What are you asking me for, stupid? You can see for yourself when you take his hat off.
Thank goodness, saved by the bell. Hello? Oh, it's you, Mrs. Updike. What's that? Do we carry dandruff removers? Oh, sure. I'll send something right out. Yeah, it's a fine old Indian remedy for removing dandruff. A tomahawk.
Mars Incorporated, makers of Milky Way candy bars, present Fountain of Fun. We hope you will enjoy this program today as much as you will always enjoy the taste of a Milky Way. At work or play, a tasty bar of Milky Way is a delightful treat. As a pick-me-up during the day, or as a wholesome, nourishing taste treat for the children after school, Milky Way candy bars have become an American institution. Every day, countless thousands of Milky Ways are placed in lunchboxes throughout America and are taken to busy factories. Then, at lunchtime, that Milky Way in the lunchbox becomes a luxurious dessert. Unusual as a dessert because of its extremely high nutritional value. And even more unusual because of its rare, delightful taste. With each bite, the pure milk chocolate coating, the layer of smooth, creamy caramel, and the luscious center of chocolate nougat flavored with real malted milk melt into that thrilling taste blend found only in a Milky Way. When you crave good candy, eat a Milky Way.
Our second show from the Fountain of Fun. And I do want to thank the thousands of people who wrote, especially the four people who mailed their letters. Of course, the autograph hounds were terrible after last week's show. I had to run as fast as I could. Even then, I couldn't catch any of them.
Well, I like the show, Bob.
Well, John, we do have a modern program. In fact, I'd say it's ahead of the times.
Ahead of the times? What do you mean?
Well, look at Phil Davis, our chubby little orchestra leader. He's had a second front for years.
And say, Bob, wasn't that a swell party our boss, old Doc Fiddlefaddle, gave after the show?
Yeah, but that sure was a bumpy ride down to his house. Gosh, how his old Stanley steamer bounced and jerked. Stop, go. Stop, go. First time in my life I ever did the conga sitting down.
And wasn't that a sight watching Phil Brito dance with Veronica Lagoon?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, was she clumsy. You know, Phil said it was the worst dance he had all night.
Polka?
No, he just shoved her around a little. But say, I noticed you were having a little trouble with your gal, Johnny. What was the matter?
Oh, she's a graduate from Vassar, you know. And have you ever seen anything more stubborn than a Vassar grad?
Sure, a Stalingrad.
Well, you sure made a fool of yourself at the party, Bob. Acting and reciting all over the place.
Look, I'll have you know, Johnny, I was a famous performer once, and I got pictures to prove it.
You have?
Sure. Here's one right here. That fellow in back of me is my manager.
Well, what do you know? Frank Buck!
You... Your back is sore from delivering aspirin tablets? How come?
Well, it's downhill to the widders, so I rolled them down. Say, Mary, did you see this new scale that just arrived today?
Gosh, just look at that scale. That's really fancy.
Sure is. Ain't nothing tall like them old-fashioned scales that you put a penny in the slot and get a card telling your weight and fortune.
Well, what's different about this scale, Doc?
Well, here, let me show you. I think I got a penny in my pocket. Yep. Now, I just stand on the scale here, see? And then I drop my penny in the slot.
Thank you very much.
Gosh, it's tough.
Shh. Your weight is exactly 142 pounds, 7 5/8 ounces, including the bottle.
Guys, lost 3 ounces. Better get that bottle filled again, I guess.
Next, please.
Bill Brito, you try it.
Sure, Mary.
Thank you very much.
Don't mention it.
Your weight is exactly 155 pounds.
Why, gosh, I weigh more than that. Look, I'm husky. I was a star athlete at college.
First string on the football team?
No, second string on the yo-yo team.
Next, please.
Go on, Bob. You get on the scale.
Okay.
Well, well, an Indian head, Penny.
You... Never mind the comment. How much do I weigh?
Just a moment until I untie this string. There now. Your weight is exactly 63 pounds, Shorty.
63 pounds? Say, what do you think I am? A skeleton?
No, and you're no Bob Hope either.
You...
Next, please.
Bill Davis. Come on, Phil, you're next.
Is it free if I guess my weight within a certain number of ounces?
Ounces, he says.
Oh, just step right on the scale there, Phil. That's the way.
Please, one at a time.
Drop your penny in the slot, Phil.
Listen, I don't mind weighing people, see? I don't mind weighing them if they weigh 10 pounds. And I don't mind weighing them if they weigh 10 tons. But if you want to get weighed in here, mister, get out of that blimp.
Is there anyone around who cannot see? It's the well-known runaround you're giving me. I suppose you tell me I'm all wrong. It's a bitter pill to take, coming from you. Though I've made a big mistake, what can I do? I don't know what makes me string along. I don't want you, but I hate to lose you. You've got me in between the devil and the deep blue sea. I forgive you, 'cause I can't forget you. You've got me in between the devil and the deep blue sea. I ought to cross you off my list, but when you come knocking at my door, fate seems to give my heart a twist, and I keep running back for more. I should hate you, but I guess I love you. You've got me in between the devil and the deep blue sea. Take it down. Da da do dee dee da da do do dee dee da 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 la dee da da do do dee. Dee dee do dee da da do dee dee dee. The devil and the deep blue sea. I ought to cross you off my list, but when you come knocking at my door, fate seems to give my heart a twist, and I keep running back for more. I should hate you, but I guess I love you. You've got me in between the devil and the deep blue sea. I'm bewildered, excited, I'm up a tree between the devil and the deep blue sea.
Well, that's nice going, Philip. Nice going.
Hello.
Well, look who's here. Veronica Lagoon. Oh, yeah. Oh, those lovely cheeks, Veronica. Did anyone ever tell you they have the color of a flower?
Have they, Bobby?
Yeah. Pillsbury's best.
Oh. Well, I guess you'd be pale, too, if you spent all day indoors over a hot welding torch.
Welding torch? You mean you're being taught welding at business school now?
Uh-huh. Well, I could have studied sewing instead, but I thought welding was more feminine.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Tell me, Veronica, do you find welding very interesting?
Oh, fascinating, Bobby. It's more fun sparking with the teacher.
Sparking, yeah. So you're probably carrying the torch for the welding teacher, huh?
Well, he's awfully nice, Bobby.
Good looking?
Well, no, but he's very strong.
I see. Plenty of power, but not enough Tyrone.
He took me to the football game yesterday.
Oh, the football game, huh? Say, I was there, too. Did you have good seats?
No. You sat on the 40-yard line.
Oh. You sat on the 40-yard line? Well, what's wrong with that?
The players kept knocking us down all the time.
You...
But I love football, Bobby. You know, I used to go with a fellow who was a triple threat man.
Oh, a triple threat man. You mean he could kick, lug, and pitch, too?
No. Kiss, hug, and pitch, woo! Oh.
Get out of here, will you?
Oh, Bobby, I want to buy a few things. Because this evening I'm going to be downtown selling tickets at the servicemen's dance.
Oh, so you're going to sell tickets at the servicemen's dance, huh?
Yeah. Now, I want a jar of cold cream, a box of powder, a lipstick, a box of rouge, a jar of eyeshadow, and a tube of mascara. Oh, yes, a bottle of stockings. Size 9.
You... Gosh, Veronica, do you think all that stuff is going to help you get the Navy's E?
Oh, no. The Marines are.
The Marines.
Stepping out brightly with Conchita, Marquita, Lolita, Pepita, Rosita, Juanita, Lopez. Nice going, fellas. Nice going.
Yep, that was a right snappy jig, Bucky. Should have brung along my castanets. Hey, Bob, where's the pinball game? I don't see the pinball game.
No, they had to take it out to be repaired. But see that little man over there?
Yeah.
Pickpocket. They sent him over to take its place.
Well, that's a good idea. Should have thought of it long ago. Well, don't want to waste too much time, Bucky. Got a lot of things to do.
Uh-huh.
Got to stop in at the hotel and check on the test run of the new roller towel. Want to go to the barbershop and see if the new police cadet's in yet. And I got to get to the firehouse. I'm scheduled for the swing shift in the pinochle game.
Oh, you sure are a busy man, Doc. I don't see how you manage it at your age.
My age? Oh, fiddle-faddle.
Well, after all, you know.
Hey, somebody call me? Thought I heard my name.
No, forget it.
Well, I've got to stop in the draft board, too, to see how things are going.
Oh, Doc, quit kidding yourself. They're not interested in you.
Don't be too sure about that, Bucky. They're going to take just about everybody. When they give you your physical examination now...
If the body's warm, you're in.
Well, that's pretty good, Johnny. And just exactly the way I heard it.
Hey, by the way, Doc, I noticed you walked over here today. Where's your bicycle?
Getting it overhauled, Bucky. I had to do something. I pedaled and pumped till I was blue in the face, and I still couldn't make this new 35-mile speed limit.
Pardon me, Bobby. I hope I'm not interrupting anything.
No, it's all right, Mary. You're not interrupting anything. Believe me.
I just remembered. Tomorrow is my boyfriend's birthday, and I haven't gotten anything for him. What would you suggest?
Well, how about a cigarette lighter?
Oh, no. Bertie doesn't smoke.
Oh. Maybe a bottle of wine?
That wouldn't do either. He never drinks.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have an awfully nice set of poker chips.
No. Bertie would never dream of gambling.
Hey, I know just the thing for this fella.
You do, Doc?
Sure. Get him a little polish for his halo.
I'm tired of feeling blue. I wanna know just how I stand with you. And now that you're in my embrace, this is the time, this is the place. As long as you're not in love with anyone else, why don't you fall in love with me? You're driving me crazy, baby, trying to guess. Will you tell me no or will you tell me yes? You gotta go overboard for someone someday. Believe it or not, it's bound to be. As long as you're not in love with anyone else, why don't you fall in love with me?
As long as you're not in love with anyone else, why don't you fall in love with me?
You're driving me crazy, baby, trying to guess. Will you tell me no or will you tell me yes?
You gotta go overboard for someone someday. Believe it or not, it's bound to be.
As long as you're not in love with anyone else, why don't you fall in love with me?
His heart is breaking.
Oh, why don't you fall in love with me?
Ba-da-loo-la-doo.
Why don't you fall in love with me?
Sylvester, what's that? Oh, you have a terrible hangover. Yeah, well, why don't you dissolve a couple of those seltzer tablets in a glass of water and... Oh, I see. You can't stand the noise. Say, but Doc, come to think of it, you don't look quite as chipper as usual. How do you feel?
Oh, not so good, Bucky. I got a pain in my loge.
No, you mean leg.
No, I mean loge.
But a loge is a seat.
That's right, Bucky. A horse bit me when I wasn't looking.
And that's not the doll that's wrong with you, Doc. You look all sprung out of shape.
Well, I got this way working in that scrap metal drive.
From working in the scrap metal drive? Well, what do you mean?
Well, you see, I went down to the waterfront to look for some scrap metal.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, I found me a beauty. A big hunk of genuine steel. Well, I bent down to pick it up.
Yeah?
And before I could get up, Bucky, four fellas put a keel on me, six men give me a triple coat of paint, and the next thing I know, Henry Kaiser is nailing the flag on another Liberty ship.
Well, maybe he did take a little beating. But if he thinks he's got troubles, listen. I've got halitosis, psychosis, neurosis, thrombosis, cirrhosis, and AIDS. Carditis, arthritis, neuritis, cystitis, but here is my principal plague. No, how can I live with this pug, ugly mug? A mug that a thug or a pug wouldn't lug. I went to the racetrack to bury my woes. A nearsighted guy put $2 on my nose. No! How can I live with this facial disgrace? I'd hate to be caught face to face with my face. I stopped at a circus one Sunday to gape. A ring-tailed monkey cried, "Look at that ape!" No! The Army, they say, is a wonderful place. But it's not the place for a guy with my face. Whenever the hour for eating drew near, the cook hollered, "Mess!" And my face answered, "Here." I have every fault you could possibly think. I'm tattletale gray, and my toothbrush is pink. Wherever I go, folks whisper, "Be all." And confidentially, I blink. Now wait just a minute. A telegram's come to my base. At last there's a place for my face. It says though you speak of your weakened physique, though your beak is unique and your technique may reek, though your poor eat-up face was your mother's disgrace, it now has this gay and high-steppin'. For your face is the ace in the armament race. Your face is our new secret weapon.
This is a variety show that aired during World War II, titled The Fountain of Fun, that was retouching photograph that had an original air date of the 11th of October, 1942. I don't really know there's not too much available on it. I think it ran for a short time. Again, it was aired during World War II, so there's some period humor there. My name is Arthur, and you're listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org. Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Let's get to this FCC obligation.
To listen to this message, a small flame can turn into a big fire. Several minutes more, and thick, poisonous smoke may have filled your lungs and reduced your ability to respond. Give it 5, and your entire home may be filled with flames.
Keep breathing. We've got you.
Don't let your world go up in smoke. Have working smoke alarms and keep heaters 3 feet away from anything that can burn. Learn more at usfa.fema.gov, because fire is everyone's fight.
Thank you, FEMA. Fire is everybody's fight. For the second half of the program, I'm going to play, this is another one I haven't really heard of before. That's why we're sifting through the old card catalog this morning. This one I found a little bit more of, Favorite Story. It ran a couple of seasons, I forget on which network. But this one's titled, it's episode 68 actually, titled Glass Eye. It's had an original air date of the 1st of January, 1949. This would be post-war, I reckon. So, it's going to feature some ventriloquism again, which is just absolutely baffles me. That's why I've been featuring it here the last several shows. Thanks for listening.
This is Ronald Coleman, inviting you to radio's most dramatic half hour, Favorite Story.
Favorite Story.
favorite story invites you to hear a story discovery. It was found on a London bookstall by Jerome Robbins, the young choreographer who did such brilliant work in the Broadway hits On the Town, High Button Shoes, and Look, Ma, I'm Dancing. Robbins thought this yarn so unusual that he immediately sent us a copy and named it his favorite story. A half dozen cables have sped back and forth across the Atlantic to obtain the rights to dramatize this strange tale. So, for all of you who like your narratives on the startling side, here's John Keir Cross's The Glass Eye. Things that are funny so that you laugh at them. And there are things that are funny, but you don't laugh at them at all. You can take, for example, the case of Julia. Is it possible to laugh at people like Julia? I've never been able to. Yet Julia is funny. There's something funny in that gaunt shape, in those wide and earnest eyes, and the red, moist tip of that nose of hers that seems longer than any nose in the world. Julia is over 40, 42 to be exact. A friend of mine, a man who makes up verse for the magazines, wrote a poem about Julia. He called it To Julia, a song for a lost, mad girl. And it went like this. Oh, she thought she was in China and a million miles away, all among the tall pagodas where the shining geishas play. And the mockingbirds were singing and the lanterns burning red, and the temple bells were ringing softly, softly in her head. Now, Julia isn't really mad, just strange. You'd be strange, too, if you led the life Julia leads. I want you to hear a story about Julia. Since most of what happened is so terribly personal, let's climb the stairs to Julia's dusky little flat and sit down next to her, as if we weren't even there, and try to listen to what goes on inside her head.
It didn't happen. It never happened. I might have imagined it, you know. Yet this room is real enough. The yellow wallpaper stained with damp at the corners. The washstand. The gas ring a trifle rusty. The mantel shelf with the 8-day clock. And in front of it, on a square of velvet, the glass eye, his glass eye, as real as anything else in the room. No. I mustn't look at it. I mustn't keep it there as a terrible reminder. Why? It's the only memory I have. The only memory. It started late one summer. It was warm in London. I was working for Mr. Mofrey, a solicitor. I remember turning on my stool and waiting until he had finished writing a sentence in a law brief. Mr. Mofrey.
Yes, Miss Benson?
Would you mind, Mr. Mofrey, if I left about 20 minutes early this afternoon?
Oh? What's the special occasion, Miss Benson?
I have to meet a train. My sister's boy is coming to spend a few days with me. They live in Lister.
Oh, yes, that's the crippled lad, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Mofrey. My sister likes to spend a bit of time visiting her husband's people in Wales. And so Bernard comes to London. I do my best to show the poor little chap a good time.
That's very generous of you, Miss Benson. What sort of things do you do to amuse the lad?
I take him to the cinema, buy him a toy. He's a quiet child. He doesn't ask for much.
Hunsecker down the hall mentioned that there was a good bill at the Old Palace Music Hall. I imagine the lad would like that. Acrobats and such. There's also a ventriloquist. One of those chaps who throws his voice.
Oh, that's a fine suggestion, Mr. Mofrey. I'll get tickets for tonight. Thank you very much, Mr. Mofrey. I met Bernard at his train. He was a very pale child, 11 years old. We had supper at the ABC tea shop. A mutton chop apiece and a large baked potato between us. It tasted good. Bernard said very little, but it was good to eat with someone else, with a guest. We went to the theater.
and sat in red plush stalls. There was an acrobat act, a man and a woman in white tights and spangled panties. I'm afraid I found it rather dull. Now, let me see, Bernard, what's next? Max Collodi, I guess you pronounce it. The gentleman ventriloquist with his amazing dummy, George. Oh, I think this will amuse you, Bennett. The curtain rose, and I saw him.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I and my talented little dummy here will be pleased to entertain you.
Watch out who you're calling a dummy, Max. You're not so smart yourself.
How about a song, George? A nice, smart song.
Don't mind if I do, Max, old man. Isn't he dull?
Go ahead, George.
Stop shoving me, Max. I'm going. There was I, awaiting at the church. Awaiting at the church. Awaiting at the church. This year, girl, she looked.
As he sat there on the stage with the spotlight on him, I knew there was no one more handsome in the whole world than Max Collodi. His dark hair gleamed, his shoulders were so broad. George, the dummy on his knee, was a grotesque doll about 3 feet high. I hardly listened to their act. I just stared and stared at the incredibly handsome young man. And I knew then that there could be no other man in all the world for me but the ventriloquist, Max Collodi. I took Bernard home as if I were in a dream. I gave him a cup of hot milk and put him to bed in a cot behind a curtain. Then I went to bed at the far side of the room. I lay for a long time staring at the ceiling, listening to the night sounds. Footsteps through the window from the street. The slow footsteps of a policeman. The strolling footsteps of lovers. Lovers. Lovers.
Oh, come on. Come on now.
And all the time I kept thinking of Max Collodi. Mrs. Max Collodi. Madame Collodi. Or is it Signora Collodi? Oh, footsteps mount on the stairs. The young man in the flat about coming home. But suppose I was Signora Collodi. Right now, I'm lying in the upper room of our villa in Italy. Max has been appearing at the theater. He's coming home now, dead tired. It's his footsteps coming up the stairs. In another moment, the door will open. He'll come in. He'll lean down and kiss me. I'll hold him very close. It is the young man upstairs. He's going into his flat. Signora Collodi. After Bernard went back to Lister, I went to the music hall again. I prayed that Max Collodi would still be there. He was. He was. It was his last night. I sat so impatiently through the dreadful acrobat act. And then he came on. He came on. I didn't listen to his act at all. I just stared at him.
A ventriloquist doll am I. A ventriloquist doll, that's all.
And that's all you are, son.
Well, don't rub it in, man. Don't rub it in.
I didn't care what George was. It was Max, his master, I cared about. What a nice small bow he made. Such gentlemanly restraint. Bowing without standing up, with the dummy still on his knee. They were applauding him, my Max. It was impossible to believe that anybody could be so handsome. I had to see him again. I had to know where he was going from here. I bought a copy of Stage. Here it is. Finsbury next week, then Strotham, Bradford, Blackpool. Yes. Yes. I'm going to do it. Mr. Murphy.
Yes, Miss Benson.
I wish to give my notice.
Huh?
I'm leaving your service.
Leaving, Miss Benson? Whatever for? Aren't you happy here?
I must be frank with you, Mr. Murphy. I am not. I'm leaving to go with the man I'm in love with. I said that so surely, so certainly, like a young girl. Oh, but I never would have said it if I knew then what I know now. As I sit here in the room with the yellow wallpaper, looking at that hideous thing on my mantelpiece, the glass,
We're ready for Act Two of this week's favorite story. Lurien Tuttle stars as Julia in John Keir Cross's remarkable tale called The Glass Eye. Julia sits in the half light of her room, hardly daring to look at her mantelpiece. For there, on a square of black velvet, is the glass eye.
Why did I do it? Years of loneliness, solitary meals, an ugly room with yellow wallpaper. No one to love. And then suddenly, Max Collodi. I had a small capital simply invested. I'd accumulated it through many years of saving. I drew it all out. I would live on this and follow Max Collodi around the country. Just looking at him, sitting there so handsome in the spotlight on the stage. Just looking at him was enough. I went to every performance he gave for weeks, paying my 3 shillings 6, sitting in the darkness, looking at the light. But then I felt I had to meet him. Maybe. If I were bold enough, I would even go up to him and say, Mr. Collodi, I enjoy your performance very much. And perhaps even shake his hand quickly for just a moment. At Strotham, I got up enough courage and waited at the stage entrance in the shadows.
Good night,
Pop. You're on performance tonight. Walk those boobs out front on a winter chuckle.
Two little things. Here's the
I watched them all go out. The acrobat, the fat lady who rode the bicycle in the closing act. The juggler with the funny ears. But no. No Max Collodi. I waited a long time. They started to turn out all the lights. The old man at the stage door started to lock up the theater. I walked up to him slowly.
Who's that?
I beg your pardon, sir. I'm sorry to bother you.
Yes. What do you want?
I know you'll think this is very odd. But can you tell me if Max Collodi has come out yet?
You're waiting for Max Collodi?
Yes.
Well, that's a good one. She's waiting for Max Collodi.
I knew I wasn't good enough for him. People would laugh. I was old, and he was young and handsome. But even so, I wrote Max Collodi a letter. I wrote it very carefully. I told him how much I enjoyed his performance and wondered if perhaps I might be privileged to meet him. Days later, I received a reply. I tore open the letter. But my dear Miss Benson, I am grateful for your praise. I regret to say, however, that I never grant interviews. Cordially yours, Max Caloti. But I kept going to his performances, and I kept on writing to him. It surprised me very much that he went on replying. And as time passed, he seemed to grow warmer in his letters, even friendly. Once in Bradford, he asked me to send him a photograph. I found a blurred snapshot of myself. In it, I appeared on a lawn against a background of fuchsia and veronica bushes, very shy, with my head to one side. It was a very old snapshot, a daylight exposure print on matte paper. People had said in those days that it was a dead spit image of me. The bobbed hair caught up in a bandeau of Japanese silk. The frock with no waist that ended above the knee. The earrings of emerald cut glass. But it was a picture of me at 23. I shouldn't have sent it. The whole thing wouldn't have happened if I hadn't sent that picture. It was at Blackpool that I finally met Max Caloti. I'd been suggesting again and again in my letters that someday we might meet. And finally a letter came. A very special letter. I ripped it open. Dear Miss Benson, I believe that I might grant you a short interview, but we must make certain conditions. You are to stay only for 5 minutes this first time. Later on, perhaps, if you still wish to go on seeing me, we might arrange longer appointments. I wish to state at this time that I have an aversion in real life to strong light, being so much in my professional life under the glare of the lines and the footlights. So my hotel room will be dimly lit. If you do not mind being received in a half-lit hotel bedroom by a strange man with no other chaperone beside my dummy, George. Hey, my. Then would you come to the Seabank Temperance Hotel, Mortimer Street, Blackpool, at 10 p.m. on Saturday evening next, after my show at the Winter Garden Theater. At that time, I will be happy to tell you something about myself. And to hear in return something about you. Oh, I'm going to meet him. I'm going to meet Max Caloti. All day that Saturday I spent in front of the mirror at the boarding house where I was staying. But powder and lip rouge, used discreetly, of course, could not make me look 23 again. All the makeup in the world couldn't keep me from looking 42. I spent hours of agony before I could make up my mind what to wear. In the end, I knew there was no hope of looking like the snapshot. And I blessed Max for suggesting that the room be dim and that the interview last only 5 minutes. At 10 minutes to 10, I was walking up and down in a dark place near his hotel, waiting. It was the longest 10 minutes I had ever spent in my life. I glanced at my watch. 2 minutes to 10. I pushed open the screen door of the hotel and walked up to the reception desk.
Yes, lady?
Could you tell me the number of Mr. Max Caloti's room, please?
Number 7 on the first floor. Stairway to your left.
As I walked across the lobby, I felt his eyes on my back. I mounted the stairs, taking care not to trip over the worn carpet. I dabbed at the tip of my nose with a small scented handkerchief. At of roses from Boots at 4 and 6 the bottle. Number 5. Number 6. Number 7.
Won't you come in?
was sitting behind a large mahogany table. Even in the dim light, I could not mistake him. He was so handsome. He didn't get up. He just inclined his head in the brusque, slightly stiff way I knew so well. It was the bow with which he acknowledged applause in the theater.
Dear lady, pray sit down.
Thank you. I didn't know what to say. What was there to say? To gain time, I quickly glanced around the room. An ordinary room with flowered wallpaper. There was a bed, a wardrobe, a small chest of drawers. Rolled grotesquely on a chair to Max's left was the dummy George. So lifeless there in the half-light. Mr. Collodi.
Max Collodi at your service.
Mr. Collodi. My voice sounded thin and false. Not myself speaking at all, but someone else. Someone else in my body. Trembling, aching, sickened stomach. And suddenly this swept into me as I sat there. A terrible and overwhelming desire. I wanted to touch Max Collodi. Just to touch him once. To touch his hands, his forehead, his blue-tinted jaw. It was a craving so terrible I could not resist. I got up. I stood for a moment, staring wildly, hardly breathing. I walked quickly around the table.
Madam, what are you doing?
I touched him on the cheek and... Look! He toppled sideways and fell from his chair. George was standing up on the chair, his hideous face twisted with rage. And as I stared, I realized that the dummy George was a living creature. And that what I had loved was nothing but wood and claws and glass. At last I had met Max Collodi, the ventriloquist. I stared at the dummy on the floor, the beautiful staring face I had loved so much. One eye was gone and fodder poured from his head, but it still smiled. And all the time that misshapen dwarf was weeping. That unlovable thing, the real Max Collodi, who had worked the movements of that handsome mouth with strings and wires. How could he have hoped to get away with it? He who was as hungry for affection as I was. I started to run from the room. My foot trod on something round and hard. I stooped and picked it up, then ran screaming from the hotel. It was the glass eye. The glass eye of the thing on the floor. The glass eye that rests now as a terrible relic on its black velvet pad on my mantelpiece.
Now that is a story. Tell me honestly, did you ever think that the real ventriloquist would turn out to be just a dwarf? And that the big handsome man was really only the dummy? Well, it had me surprised. That's what we call a switch ending. And it's the kind that would have made O. Henry proud indeed. Loreen Tuttle is to be warmly congratulated for her fine acting as Julia. And Byron Kane deserves a bow for his portrayal of Max Collodi, both sizes. Claude Sweeten, as always, composed and conducted the music. Jerome Lawrence and Robert E. Lee wrote and directed this pre-radio adaptation of John Keir Cross's The Glass Eye. Our thanks also to choreographer Jerome Robbins, who chose The Glass Eye as this week's favorite story.
Yeah, we heard episode 68, a favorite story, Glass Eye, had an original air date of the 1st of January, 1949. Nothing like kicking off a new year with another ventriloquist story on the radio. It's kind of interesting, because when she had that snapshot, it was 20 years old. Nowadays, people can't go 20 minutes without taking a snapshot. Anyway, my name is Arthur, and you've been listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford. Tufts Freeform Radio. If you're listening live, Julian and Sound Slaking is coming up next. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Welcome. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to my second episode of Sound Slaking after taking a week off last week. We have some nice tunes prepared for you all today. And good way to start off your morning, I think. Here we'll start off. I'd like to create a little bit of a tradition of starting each set with a short little interlude, and as the moment I having some technical difficulties at the moment, I'm new to public radio, and you know, I apologize for this inconvenience.